From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
War fever. The temperatures are rising. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Obama administration is escalating the case for going back to Iraq, this time to fight the extremist group ISIL, and not just with bombing. America's top commander told a Senate committee today U.S. soldiers might join the battle despite the president's promise of no boots on the ground. The public may be ready to hear the message. Videos of beheadings by ISIL have generated alarm, and polls show real fear for America's homeland. We'll hear conflicting opinions about that threat, the president's leadership, and whether Congress will get involved before the midterm elections. Today's talking point, will Scotland vote to go it alone? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. In 2 days, Scottish voters may put an end to the United Kingdom as the world has known it for 307 years. Britain's rival political parties, meantime, have gotten together to promise extensive new powers for Scotland if voters reject independence. We'll hear what's at stake. First, his news update. Just last week, President Obama said once again that his reluctant return to military action in Iraq would not involve American ground forces. Today, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and General Martin Dempsey, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Dempsey defended the president's strategy of seeking partners in the fight against ISIL.
My view at this point is that this coalition is the appropriate way forward. I believe that will prove true. But if it fails to be true, and if there are threats to the United States, then I, of course, would go back to the president and make a recommendation that may include the use of U.S. military ground forces.
Mark Thompson is national security and military correspondent for Time magazine. Hi, Mark. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
Have we heard before by General Dempsey or anybody else the idea that there might be armed forces on the ground? The president has said again and again that won't be the case.
Well, that's what the president has said, and as General Dempsey pointed out this morning, three times, actually, before anybody asked him about it, that if the going gets tough there, we might have to bring in, shall we say, handfuls of special forces, of tactical air controllers to call in ground strikes. He did say, you know, we're not going to go in on the ground in a big way with our flags unfurled and American divisions rushing in, but he did. Some people have said he'd opened the door to that notion, and I think that's what happened today. He thinks that that might be necessary, but that's a minority view, probably not.
Minority view? He's the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
No, what I mean is he said he doesn't think that will be necessary. But if it is, he would not hesitate to ask the president.
People with a sense of history might remember the advisors in Vietnam.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, what the Pentagon is now saying is those guys over there and gals are doing the three A's. They're assessing, they're advising, and they're assisting, but they're not attacking. You know, they've been really hard and fast on that. You almost got the sense listening to General Dempsey this morning that he was sort of trying to say, hey, that's where we are now, but if this situation heads south and if we can't gin up this alliance, including moderate Syrian rebels, we might have to do more. And I think he was sort of laying down a marker to that effect today.
How did the senators respond?
Well, plainly, I mean, it's very interesting. Basically, the senators were a lot more hawkish than many of the protesters who kept being thrown out of the hearing all day. Whenever anybody new would speak, somebody would get up and say, we don't want a new war, you know, shame on you, Senator. And the senators, by and large, especially the Republicans, were saying, we need to do more, we need to do more. Even some Democrats were leaning that way, but Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, basically said, we've been doing this for 13 years. He laid out all of the costs, both in blood and treasure, that America has spent since October 7th of 2001, beginning in Afghanistan, and said, why do we think it's going to be any different this time? And that was a question that just sort of hung over the entire enterprise.
Why different this time? Suggesting, in other words, that we might just see the same continuing situation with escalation and no ultimate resolution?
Well, it was sort of bizarre to listen to Secretary Hagel talk about what a nifty job the U.S.-led coalition would do in terms of training and equipping the moderate Syrian rebels. Now, mind you, we did that in Afghanistan, and they weren't rebels. They were the government. We did that in Iraq. They weren't rebels. They were the government. And both of them, you know, haven't met expectations. So the notion of doing that essentially for a rebel force whose key enemy is Bashar al-Assad and not ISIS, ISIL, or the Islamic State is somewhat discombobulating.
Was there concern on the part of the senators that if, in fact, the United States did help the rebels in Syria, they would also be helping Assad against ISIS or ISIL?
Yeah, I mean, that was a clear concern of Senator John McCain. I think it was McCain who said, listen, if we send these rebels in and all of a sudden Assad starts bombing them from the sky as these moderate rebels take on ISIS, what are we, the United States, going to do? Are we going to shoot down the Syrian Air Force planes that are doing that? And he did not get a satisfactory answer to that question. But plainly, I mean, that's a real pickle, and I think that's why there was a large degree of skepticism about the merit or the ability of the U.S. to train the moderate Syrian rebels in Saudi Arabia.
So issues then arose with both with regard to Iraq and Syria.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. If you paid close attention, General Dempsey, I think it was in his opening statement, said we're going to destroy ISIS in Iraq and we're going to disrupt them in Syria. Well, that's sort of a caveat I don't think we've heard before. He went on to explain that, okay, after we disrupt them in Syria, it's going to be up to this moderate Syrian rebel force, as well as the indigenous population there, to get rid of them.
Again, we're talking with Mark Thompson, who's with Time Magazine. In a moment, war fever. The temperature is rising on To The Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Ollie back with To The Point, once again talking with Mark Thompson at Time Magazine about this testimony today before the Senate. We heard at the outset General Dempsey saying that, of course, the coalition is what they are relying on the most. What about the coalition, and to what extent is it really coming together with any serious promises of assistance, either with bombing or troops on the ground?
Well, Warren, when you speak to folks in the Pentagon, they basically say that's not our problem. They point across the river at the State Department. Secretary of State John Kerry has been flying all over Europe for the past 2 weeks, and there hasn't been a lot forthcoming. And as Secretary Hagel said at the hearing earlier today, we want to get all of our ducks in a row. We've spoken to 40 countries, and when we're ready, we'll roll them all out at once. He also stated it was important for the local populations in Iraq and Syria to hear from, countries in the region denouncing ISIS and saying, we're coming after you. And, of course, that hasn't happened yet, really, in a major way. And so there was some sort of a disconnect because people are still waiting for, this is the most heavily armed region in the world, and yet you've got all these folks with these massive air forces, much of it provided by the United States, sort of sitting on the sidelines as the U.S. is conducting these bombing runs over Iraq and soon over Syria.
And those bombing runs have begun in Iraq, and it's definite they're going to happen in Syria? We have no doubt about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's preordained. I mean, something could derail it. But yesterday, for example, And the day before, the U.S. attacked a couple of targets southwest of Baghdad. That's notable because a big concern in the Pentagon has been if ISIS gets into Baghdad in any way and conducts a series of terrorist strikes, it will have an effect, some people say, much like the Tet Offensive in Vietnam in 1968 did. Even when the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong did not prevail militarily there and then, the notion they could get into the capital of the nation and cause destruction really upset people politically and soured a lot of Americans on the war. And there is a concern that that could happen in Baghdad. So that's why you're now seeing the bombing beginning to come down on ISIS forces closer to the capital city of Iraq.
Mark Thompson, again, national security and military correspondent for Time Magazine. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Sure thing, Warren.
Once again, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel also testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee today about the threat from ISIL or ISIS. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
We are at war with ISIL as we are with al-Qaeda. But destroying ISIL will require more than military efforts alone. It will require political progress in the region and effective partners on the ground in Iraq and Syria.
Daniel Benjamin was the top counterterrorism advisor at the State Department during the president's first term, President Obama's first term. He is now director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. Daniel Benjamin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we just heard that things get passed back and forth between the Pentagon and the State Department. Now we're over on the State Department side. Do you think that the threat of ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State against the United States is being exaggerated?
I think the threat of ISIS to the region is quite significant, and it has had a really serious destabilizing effect. And for that reason alone, I think the president has come up with a good and appropriate strategy for dealing with it. I do believe that the domestic discussion, much of it on Capitol Hill, some of it on the airwaves, has been rather overheated and has distorted the extent to which there is a threat to the United States at home. There is certainly a threat to our interests abroad and to individuals, American individuals, who may be in the region. But this is a group that has no history of carrying out complex transnational covert terrorist operations. It is very much focused on the sectarian conflict and the insurgency in Iraq. And while it could well develop into a terrorist threat, and that's another reason to take it seriously, it has not yet shown that that inclination. It has a safe haven, it has money, it has foreign fighters with cultural literacy to operate in the West. But so far, as one administration official after another has said, there is no imminent plotting going on. They haven't detected any conspiracies.
As to the concern, which you referred to a moment ago, as overheated and distorted, at one point you called it a farce, did you not, to the conversation that's going on in public?
Yes, and that was my word, and I'm standing by it. The allegations that there are, as the governor of Texas has said, ISIS operatives streaming across the border into Texas, that as some talking heads have said, that our cities are filled with sleeper cells from ISIS, that they are preparing an Ebola biological weapon to attack our mass transit systems with, and so on. I mean, this is just fanciful and has, I think, a lot to do with why the American public feels so strongly that ISIS is an imminent threat to it. I mean, I'll be very frank and say I think some administration spokesmen have at times also exercised poor message discipline and suggested that it was more of a threat to Americans at home. But that threat is not yet materialized, and I think that that has distorted the debate. As I said, I think the president's got the right idea in the region, we've spent billions and billions of dollars on intelligence collection and on homeland security over the last 12 or so, 13 years, and I do not think that this is an enormous threat to the homeland right now.
Daniel Benjamin, the leading counterterrorism advisor at the State Department during President Obama's first term. Janet Hook is with us, political and congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Good to have you on our program again.
Thanks, Warren.
Tell us a bit about public opinion and the response to what Mr. Benjamin refers to as a distorted kind of, a debate that has distorted the reality.
Well, we've done some polling about the subject over the last week, both before and after President Obama gave his speech to the nation. And we actually have found that people are paying quite a lot of attention. A lot of people listened to the speech, and President Obama got a lot of support for his decision to take military action in the area in response to ISIS. And my sense and my reading of our poll finding is that the main thing isn't so much the distortions or lack thereof in the public discussion, but that people are really responding very viscerally to the videotapes of the beheadings of Americans. I mean, that really brought it home in a very vivid way of the sort of emotional reaction that it takes to get Americans interested in supporting military action.
What about what we heard earlier on the program? You weren't with us, but with the testimony today before the Armed Services Committee, where General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, suggested that, in fact, American troops might end up being involved if necessary, if the coalition wasn't doing the job. Can you tell, Janet Hook, from the polling that has been done, or can the pollsters tell, if, in fact, Americans would support that?
Well, I was actually personally very surprised when we did our poll last week before President Obama's speech. We asked people what kind of military action they'd be willing to support. And in fact, we found that 34% of the people that we surveyed said that they would support combat troops. 40% said just keep it limited to airstrikes, which is what we're doing now. But another, like I said, 34% said airstrikes and combat troops. Now, I kind of wonder how sustained that support would be, because until recently, probably until these beheadings happened, our polling had been showing very kind of not quite isolationist sentiment in the country, but more kind of a real reluctance to intervene and use American troops.
So there does appear to be a change. How do people feel about how safe they are now as opposed to how safe we were before September 11th, 2001?
Well, that was another really striking finding we had. We asked people the question, do you feel more safe or less safe than you did before, or is the country more safe or less safe than it was before 9/11? And 47% said they felt less safe now, and that's much more sense of insecurity than just a year ago when we only had 33% say they were less safe. We found that women were feeling more anxiety than men. I mean, it was just a very striking finding.
Women, of course, major supporters of the president in the past. How's he doing?
Well, President Obama's standing really has been particularly in a decline on the question of how he's handling foreign policy. His general approval rating is low. It's been low for a while. It hasn't dropped that much more, but specifically on foreign policy, it's dropped to its record low in September. We found it was down to 32%, and it had been its record low last month, too.
Again, Janet Hook is political and congressional correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, which has just conducted the polling that she described. Daniel Benjamin, back to you, formerly with the State Department, now at the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth. Is this a fear, there's no other word to call it, I think, if 47% fear will think we're less safe than we were before September 11th, is this justified?
No, absolutely not. It's important to remember that for a year and a half after 9/11, for example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the most capable terrorist planner ever, was still at large. Osama bin Laden was still at large. Much of the al-Qaeda senior leadership was still at large. We were in much greater peril in that period and for several years after, I would argue, than we are now. As I said before, this is a group that doesn't have a history of terrorist attacks outside of its own region. In fact, there's no evidence of any plotting going on. We heard that from National Counterterrorism Center Director Matt Olson. We've heard it from a number of other senior officials. So, whether it's the videos themselves and their endless repetition, or whether it's just the vast amount of time on cable news channels that's being filled up with speculation about this group, or all the stuff on social media, the fears are being accelerated at warp speed, if you will, and far beyond what is justified. And just to add one note, I think that most people who have been in the counterterrorism business in recent years would say that if anything, God forbid, if anything happened in the United States right now, we'd probably be looking at Yemen and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula more than we would be looking at ISIS, because that's a more capable group that's shown a demonstrated ability to operate outside of its immediate region.
Daniel Benjamin, formerly at the State Department. Jonathan Schanzer is with us. He is Vice President for Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. That's a policy institute that focuses on foreign policy and national security. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Do you feel that the kinds of fears that Janet Hook outlined, that the polling shows, are justified? Do you disagree with Daniel Benjamin?
Well, I think part of the problem here is that we just don't have a lot of good insight into this organization. We've largely pulled out of Syria, and that also includes the intelligence collection apparatus that we had there as well. And so I think we've been largely blind to what's been going on, and maybe perhaps deliberately so. We've really decided that we did not want to engage in anything that was going on in Syria, and so there's a lot of fear. But more broadly, I would say that what we're looking at here is a reawakening, I think, of the American public, that for many years we were told that al-Qaeda was defeated, that it was decimated, that it was in a decline, that groups like ISIS were JV teams, et cetera. There was a real effort, I think, to downplay the threat of this militant strain within Islam. Granted, it's a minority strain, but yet it has been one that has threatened the United States for decades now. And I think that now that ISIS has emerged with the strength that it has, it has really struck a chord with the American public. And I think maybe one of the problems here is that the administration has not done good messaging on how we've been trying to fight this phenomenon for more than 6 years.
Do you agree with the governor of Texas that, in fact, there may be people associated with ISIS that come across the Mexican border, that there are sleeper cells in the United States as well?
I have no idea. It's impossible for me to know those sorts of things. Look, we have seen in the past, when I worked at the Treasury Department years ago, that there were threats that were coming from the Canadian border. There were threats that were potentially coming from the Mexican border. I don't know whether ISIS has these plans or not. We know that al-Qaeda has thought about these things in the past. It's impossible to know right now if you're not in the intelligence community.
So, Daniel Benjamin, let me go back to you. You obviously have a difference of opinion with Jonathan Schanzer. What about this? Is there a reawakening to a real fear, as he says? Have we been deliberately blind? Are you and others trying to play down the real danger from ISIS?
Well, I certainly don't think I'm trying to play down anything. I think that we did, over the course of two administrations, have a great deal of success against the jihadist threat. I think that it is completely true to say that the high-end threat that we worried about most, coming from the core al-Qaeda, has all but been eliminated. And that is a really important point. I think that people are understandably spun up because of the almost, monomaniacal focus on the ISIS threat that we have seen beginning with the fall of Mosul. But I continue to think that we are, in a good position for containing and diminishing this threat, and that it's been exaggerated.
Hold this thought. We will take a break, very brief break, and come back, continue this conversation. Later we'll talk about Scotland. Will it vote to go it alone on Thursday? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Public opinion shows, according to the Wall Street Journal, that people are really very worried about the possible threat to the United States, to the homeland, from ISIS or ISIL, the Islamic State. We've heard from a former counterterrorism advisor at the Department of State that it's a real threat in the Middle East, but not so much here, that we have managed to deal with the anti-American issues pretty successfully. Jonathan Schanzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy says otherwise. What evidence do you have that there really is, Jonathan Schanzer, a threat to this country directly when Mr. Benjamin, who was the top counterterrorism official in the State Department, says that, in fact, the ISIS has just simply never shown the ability to reach across the ocean?
Well, look, it's a tough question to answer, primarily, again, because I don't think we have good eyes and ears on the ground in Syria. I think maybe we're starting to again, but for many, for the last 2 years, I think we've deliberately decided to look the other way, and I think it's for that reason that many people were surprised. Look, I think there was an attempt to hopefully just let the Syrian crisis resolve itself and for the United States to remain kind of an outsider during this. And I think that, you know, we saw the withdrawal of our embassy. We saw very little in the way of assets put on the ground for collection. And as a result, I think we were flying blind. And so I think the sudden spike in ISIS activity has alarmed people. The concern that I think that we should all be looking at is the foreign fighter phenomenon, not just from the United States, where there's maybe 100 or 300, depending on the numbers that you're looking at, of Americans who've gone to fight over there, but also Europeans, Canadians. They're going to come home. And this is something that we saw during the Afghan jihad, that foreign fighters, when they came home, they would create new cells and look for opportunities to attack the United States or perhaps other Western countries. I think this is a real possibility with ISIS, that the amount of jihadi activity that we're seeing in Syria and Iraq right now should be alarming. And if we use the past as a guide, then I think that, you know, just because ISIS has not attacked the United States yet doesn't mean that it won't. I could say the same thing about al-Qaeda, that it didn't do that for many years, and then all of a sudden we find that it attacked us on the homeland. You know, I just think we need to be vigilant. I think we understand this ideology is very dangerous and that those who fight on behalf of this ideology are capable of many, many things.
Let me go quickly back to Daniel Benjamin. With regard to the ideology issue, is ISIS's primary focus on the United States? Is that also true of al-Qaeda? And if so, what's the reason for it? Is it because of things that the United States has done in the Middle East, or is it simply because of what we stand for and who we are?
So ISIS and al-Qaeda really grow out of the same seedbed, but they've taken two very different directions, in both cases nourished by the radical ideology that they grew out of. For al-Qaeda, we are the number one target. There's no question about that. But for ISIS, the strategy has been quite different. They want to create a true radical Islamist state. They want to have whole territory. They want to be in the Middle East. And they want to kill Shia on the grand scale. For them, killing Shia, this sectarian conflict, which has been growing since the Iranian Revolution, is the number one goal. And I think it's really important for the United States to step back and wonder whether and to what extent this is about us, because sometimes we think things are about us when they're really not. And then we're in a position to make serious mistakes that we will come back to regret. We saw this in Iraq with Saddam Hussein. We saw this also in Vietnam. So, you know, it's an important cautionary note, I think.
Janet Hook, still with us, political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and congressional correspondent as well. How is all of this impacting the race, particularly to control the Senate?
It's really interesting because until the last month or so, foreign policy issues were almost unmentioned in the midterm election campaigns around the country. You know, most of the time in midterms, and this year in particular, we've seen that voters cared mostly about domestic issues, and that's what candidates were talking about. And as recently as the end of July, I saw a study of campaign ads in Senate race, the major Senate races, and almost no mention of foreign policy. And now you're starting to see some more of it mentioned, mostly by Republicans who sort of see this as an opportunity to kind of broaden their critique of President Obama and say, this is another example of his feckless foreign policy leadership, and the Democrats are, you know, aiding and abetting it.
Here's an example, an advertisement for Mitch McConnell, the Republican who is running for re-election in Kentucky, has a tough Democratic challenger. He, in fact, would be the majority leader of the Senate if, in fact, he were to, the Republicans were to take over and he himself would be re-elected.
These are serious times.
That ISIS can't be defeated without hitting its
311,000 jobless claims.
Waves of unaccompanied children, 52,000.
Implementing Obamacare has the potential to be a train wreck.
We don't have a strategy yet.
In Kentucky, we have a proven leader. When so many in Washington can't do the job, shouldn't Kentucky have a senator who can? Obama needs Allison Grimes. Kentucky needs Mitch McConnell.
I'm Mitch McConnell, and I approve this message.
Allison Grimes, the Democrat who's running against Mitch McConnell. So, Janet Hook, back to you. A lot of things mixed into that commercial, a lot of themes, but beginning with foreign policy.
Right. I think that the Republicans have been trying to build this case about Obama's leadership throughout the campaign season. And I think because of the threats abroad, it kind of gives it this overlay of, you know, kind of scary, ominous music about, and, you know, visuals of foreign fighters threatening us. It kind of adds an element of drama. Now, that ad was cut and aired before President Obama announced his plans for responding. You know, whether that makes those kinds of arguments by the Republicans less potent, it remains to be seen.
But we don't see a rallying around the commander-in-chief at this point, as sometimes happens when Americans feel threatened.
Well, maybe not rhetorically on the campaign trail, but I think Congress is moving pretty quickly to give exactly what Obama requested in terms of authority to arm Syrian rebels and funding for the airstrikes and steps that he's taken. So, you know, they're kind of rallying on Capitol Hill, at least.
Okay. Janet Hook, again, a political and congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. It's always good to have you on our show, and thanks a lot for being with us this time.
You bet. Thank you.
Ross Baker is with us, professor of political science at Rutgers University. His latest book is Bipartisanship Dead. Ross Baker, good to have you with us.
Hey, Warren. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. Now, we just heard Janet Hook say that she believes with the midterm elections coming up, Congress will, in fact, give the president what he wants. And so far, as I understand it, that means money to bomb and also give support to the so-called moderate rebels in Syria. Do you think Congress is eager to do that?
Eager? No. Mm-hmm. I think that nobody wants to take a vote at this point. Everybody's facing re-election. Members of the House of Representatives are in a somewhat more protected position. Most of them have relatively easy congressional districts to defend and so on. The problem, I think, hits Senate Democrats, I think, hardest. These are people like Mark Begich of Alaska, people like Mark Pryor of Arkansas, and Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, and these are people who are running in states that were carried pretty handsomely by Mitt Romney, and to take any position on either arming the rebels or staging air attacks in Syria present a dilemma for them. They would just as soon not have to take a position at all on this. So, and that's the reason why, for example, this resolution to allow the arming and equipping of the and training of the rebels is going to be buried in something called the continuing resolution, which is the legislation that funds the government and will until the 15th of December. So both the funding part of it and the resolution allowing for the equipping and training of the rebels will expire on the 15th of December, which actually does something that members of Congress love to do, which is kicking the ball down the road, and it's kicking it into the so-called lame duck session of the 113th Congress, which will commence in December, and during which time, presumably longer-term longer-term fixes will be applied.
So it is lumped in then with the resolution to keep the government operating, which the Republicans, of course, got into trouble when they defeated in the past, so they're not likely to do it again. But it's an amendment to that resolution, and it is only temporary in nature. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. It's fascinating, Warren, how this thing plays out, because clearly the group that Harry Reid wants to protect the most are his six Democratic senators who are vulnerable. And I would throw in people like Kay Hagan of North Carolina. There is, Tom Udall, Mark Udall in Colorado, and so on. He does not want to have these people take a vote which may alienate parts of their constituency. And all of them have people who are hawks and the people who are doves and so on. So the effect of this is as follows. The House of Representatives adds the resolution on Iraq and the rebels in Syria to the continuing resolution as an amendment, and the Senate simply adopts what the House does, which spares the senators really having to debate the arming and training resolution separately. So it all gets rolled into a fiscal measure. And in a sense, it's kind of like, one of these surprise dishes in which there's a gold coin in the middle of the pudding. and that's the way this thing is going to go through.
Ross Baker again at Rutgers University. Daniel Benjamin, back to you. You were with the State Department. How important is this approval by the Congress to going forward with the president's strategy?
Well, the continuing resolution is, of course, important to the continuing of the government.
Yeah.
But
what about the amendment?
As for the rest, I'm going to have to leave that to the legislative affairs experts. It's certainly important for the president to be able to point to some congressional backing. But I think that the history here suggests that he has the authority he needs for the airstrikes. And he will want to have more for the both on the funding and on the authority side for the arming and training of the Syrian forces. Now, some, of course, have already been in various kinds of trainings, but I think to ramp it up the way he wants, he will want that language in the CR.
Jonathan Schanzer, back to you with the Foundation for a Defense of Democracy. As you're a bit more hawkish on this than Daniel Benjamin, do you think that these senators who are running for a re-election ought to be required to vote one way or the other?
Look, I think it's important to get all of our leaders on the record in terms of where they stand on this. I think, again, I'll just point back to, I think, a culture of ambivalence that we have had about the need to fight these sorts of forces. I think that we've done perhaps too good of a job in downplaying the threat, talking about the optional wars that we don't necessarily need to fight. I think that there is now a sense that we need to do this. But, of course, now the environment is not exactly conducive to a lot of these politicians who are wondering whether this is the right move. I think this is just indicative now of the culture that we have been in for the last several years. I think it's important to get people now to state exactly where they are and hopefully have an understanding that, look, we don't need to do everything that President Bush did. We also don't need to sit back and just allow problems to fester, perhaps find a middle ground. That's what I'm looking for and hoping for.
Well, where are you? What would your middle ground be? Would you want to see large numbers of troops going back into Iraq? Would you want to see troops helping out the moderates, so-called, in Syria, even if that meant helping out the president of that country, who the United States has indicated ought to leave office?
Well, look, I think we should not be cooperating with the Iranians, nor should we be cooperating with the Syrians. These are, of course, state sponsors of terrorism in their own right. I think we should not be presupposing whether we should or should not be putting boots on the ground. I think the last thing I think we'd all like to see is to see American troops in harm's way again. But to say that we know up front that that should not happen, I think, is wrong when we need to be thinking about what it takes to win. But I think the important thing here is not to let the sort of ISIS scare take over, to be very clear-eyed about what is needed to build the kind of coalitions that we need, to get the funding that we need in order to get the job done. But I think I see a lot of panic. I see a lot of anxiety. I see a lot of jockeying right now. And those are things that we should be sort of trying to avoid, obviously coming up with solutions that make sense for the country.
You talk about a need to win. What would winning mean?
Look, in my view, it's going to be about first preventing the spread of ISIS and then beginning to take away territory that ISIS has controlled. And then, look, I think one of the bigger problems here is that even if you are able to neutralize ISIS in all of Iraq, you're still going to have it in Syria. We're going to have to address this Syrian jihadi problem, the civil war that has been raging now for more than 2 years. We've had 190,000 deaths. It is chaos. And the borders at this point, I think, do not reflect a real state any longer. There is a major crisis that we have largely ignored that must be addressed.
Can we fix it? Do we have the ability to do that, either militarily or diplomatically?
I think we've lost a lot of opportunities. I think there have been points along the way where we've seen representatives of the so-called moderate opposition, where we've seen potential partners. We've chosen not to work with them for various reasons, and I think it was a mistake. Today, I see fewer and fewer options available, but that doesn't mean that there aren't options at the end of the day. I just think it's going to require more thought, more effort. We need to focus our energies now on this issue, whether it's military, diplomatic, building coalitions. We've got to start to think more creatively about this rather than hoping that it goes away.
Daniel Benjamin, back to you. We heard very early in the program that senators today, when the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense testified, asked the question, would we, in fact, if we were to commit ourselves to a greater extent militarily, simply end up again where we are now with crises that we're not in a position to resolve?
Well, I think one thing we have to come to grips with is that since the invasion of Iraq and more significantly or more recently since all the upheaval of the Arab Spring, the security situation throughout the Arab world is very, very different from what it was before. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon because many governments hollowed out in the years before the Arab Spring. And in the Arab Spring, many of the institutions that maintained order, often at a huge cost in terms of repression, are gone. And as a result, this is a region that's going to be in flux for a long time. One of the reasons why the world looks so unstable right now is that once those institutions that were maintaining order were gone, then really the worst among them, the jihadists, seized the moment and have pushed ahead with their agenda. And I'm not sure that the United States has the wherewithal to clean that all up. It's going to ultimately require that the region itself come through a long and painful passage and figure out what it wants in terms of governance, what it wants in terms of institutions.
Okay, that's all the time we have. We can certainly understand why it is, as Ross Baker at Rutgers University indicated, that members of Congress with elections coming up might not want to address themselves to these issues in any great detail. We'll see what happens. Ross Baker, again, thanks to you at Rutgers University. Thanks to the gentleman we just heard from, Daniel Benjamin, formerly with the State Department, now at the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. Jonathan Chanzer at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, where he's Vice President for Research, thanks to you, and our earlier guest, Janet Hook, political and congressional reporter for the Wall Street Journal. With just 2 days left and polls showing the vote is too close to call, campaigning for and against Scottish independence has reached a kind of crescendo. We'll hear about new promises from British politicians trying to keep the Union together in a moment on To the Point.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Well, and I'll be back with today's talking point. Britain's three political parties don't agree on much, but they are united in wanting Scotland to remain in the United Kingdom. Here's the Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron warning that independence would lead to a painful divorce.
There is no going back from this, no rerun. This is a once and for all decision. If Scotland votes yes, the UK will split and we will go our separate ways forever.
Kate Devlin is political correspondent for The Herald of Glasgow. She's been on our program before. Welcome back.
Hello.
Are Scots listening to that kind of warning from the Prime Minister of Britain?
The Prime Minister desperately hopes that they are. We're awaiting another set of opinion polls due to come out in the next couple of hours, which should give us an indication of whether Scots are listening or not. But what's happened is that because this race is so far too close to call, the No campaign, those arguing for anti-independence, have had to up their offer of what they're offering Scots. Whether it will be enough to secure victory in the early hours of Friday morning remains to be seen.
And here again is the Prime Minister, David Cameron, with the carrot that you just described for those to try to get people to vote no.
If we get a no vote on Thursday, that will trigger a major, unprecedented programme of devolution with additional powers for the Scottish Parliament. Major new powers over tax, spending, some welfare services. We've agreed a timetable for that stronger Scottish Parliament, a timetable to bring in the new powers that will go ahead if there is a no vote.
So, Kate Devlin, the public opinion polls aren't yet out. It'd be a couple of hours after our conversation. What's your sense of it? Do you think that that promise, which comes also from the other major political parties in Britain, not just from the Conservative Prime Minister, do you think that people will believe that and consequently be willing to vote no in order to keep the United Kingdom united?
There certainly is a feeling among lots of Scottish voters that this is the kind of offer that they want. They want extra power. They want more devolution to Scotland. It has to be said that what's been offered overnight is slightly vague. There's still not very much meat on the bone. And so whether it moves enough voters across remains to be seen. Alex Salmond, the leader of the Independence campaign, has today dismissed it as a desperate offer of nothing.
A desperate offer of nothing. So would that indicate that if, in fact, the polls come out indicating a preference for separation from England, that the three parties might get together again and put more meat on the bones?
Well, absolutely. This is actually the second time that they have upped their offer in the past week, ever since we had an opinion poll, which for the first time put the yes campaign, the pro-independent side, in the league. And this caused panic at Westminster. So there's absolutely the chance that, you know, within the next 48 hours before people go to the polls, that that offer will be upped one more time. And it's kind of interesting to think, where can they go from here? Because this is already causing repercussions in England and Wales, because one of the things that they said overnight is that they're going to keep a kind of spending formula that ensures that more money is spent per head on public services in Scotland than in England. And this is actually causing a bit of resentment south of the border. So what they can actually offer to Scots is starting to become a very interesting question.
And the Welsh are looking at this too, thinking maybe this should apply to them?
They are. They're thinking, you know, is there gold in those hills? Is there stuff for us as well? And it's just, it's one of those really interesting questions. Part of what's happening is that in their panic and in their desperation, the No side is trying to throw money at this problem. And that's causing repercussions in other parts of the United Kingdom.
I understand you are in the beautiful city of Edinburgh at the moment. What's it like on the street? Do you see campaign rallies? Do you see people shouting at each other or at least having serious debates about this?
We very much see people shouting at each other. One of the main No leaders, the leader of the Labour Party, Ed Miliband, had to call off a walkabout where he was supposed to meet ordinary Scottish voters in an Edinburgh shopping centre just a couple of hours ago because he was besieged by Yes campaigners who rushed him, started shouting abuse at him, followed him through the shopping centre. It's very, very tense on the streets at the moment. That said, you know, there's a lot of optimism on both sides. There's a lot of good-natured campaigning, but there's a lot of very tense and abusive campaigning as well.
Much has been said about the fact that this vote is open to people 16 years of age and older. Do we have a sense of where those young voters who've never voted for anything else before in their lives are likely to go?
We have a little bit of a sense. It's very difficult to tell. Not many opinion polls are done just amongst 16 and 17-year-olds for very obvious reasons, because they wouldn't be representative of the population. But from what we can tell, it does look as if the pro-independent side might be slightly disappointed. They are in government in Scotland. They set the franchise. They decided to give teenagers the vote because they thought they would be pro-independence and they would grasp this idea of creating a new nation. And it seems as if they are slightly more conservative than older people and that they may just vote for the status quo.
I understand families are divided in some cases about all of this. What would the mechanism for independence be? What would take place? How would it be done?
Well, if it's a yes vote on Friday, there are another 2 years of negotiations ahead. So things could get an awful lot more naughty from here. What would be done would be a kind of detailed series of negotiations between the UK government and the Scottish government. Now, that's the best-case scenario. Already, the leaders of the pro-independent side have threatened to walk out of those negotiations if they don't get a currency union, if effectively they're not allowed to use the British pound in Scotland. And not only would they walk out of those negotiations, they'd refuse to take any share of UK national debt. So already the language around this is incredibly fraught. There are threats on both sides. What the handover and what the creation of a new nation would actually look like, it's very difficult to predict at this stage.
And it sounds as if there will be a residue if, in fact, independence goes down. There's so much emotion behind all of this.
There is, and it's something that actually Canadians have warned about. Jean Chrétien, who was in charge of Canada when Quebec had its last independence referendum, came to the UK a year ago and gave a speech warning that it would create divisions within families,
right,
and that mechanisms had to be formed to try and bring them together afterwards. And actually, one of the things that we're going to see this weekend is a church service in Edinburgh designed to bring together people and
all
offer
right
a kind of sense of reconciliation.
All right. The vote will be over by then. It'll happen on Thursday. Kate Devlin with The Herald, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.